I mean, for me, it's rejuvenating, cathartic, spiritual. It's just a very happy place to be.
So my guest today is Josh Sternberg, or Sternberg if you're pitching him, and you can follow him on Twitter at Josh Sternberg. He's a former editor of Adweek. He's at NBC News, Washington Post, Digiday, and he's written for the Atlantic, Pacific Standard, and The All. He started a newsletter about 4 months ago called Media Nut, and you can subscribe by going to medianut.substack.com. And if you work in the business of media or just want to follow along as this landscape is changing, which it is, it seems like every day, I highly recommend giving him a follow on Twitter and subscribing to Media Nut as well. So, Josh, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you. I'm a big fan of your newsletter. I'm going to plug it as much as I possibly can. I think that there's been such monumental change in the media business and the advertising business. For the last couple of years now, but it seems like things are accelerating rapidly. And with newsroom layoffs and all these things, it's great to have, you know, your newsletter as a source to help follow along with everything that's going on. And I want to talk to you about some of the stuff that's in there, and then we can go from there. Your latest issue covers Volkswagen, and they were listed as number 7 on the Forbes 100 list. And I thought it was interesting because we work in a space that hypes up tech and hypes up certain industries. But when you look at the top 10, it's really not a lot of them of those companies. So can you
keep in mind that, you know, Fortune puts out two lists. They put out a global 500 list and a regular Fortune 500 list. And VW is number 7 on the global 500 list. So it's kind of like it's an interesting point of view, right? So on the one hand, like, you're right, we talk about tech a lot as these huge companies, and they are, right? They sit on hundreds of millions of dollars in cash. They have valuations that are $1 trillion. But when it comes to revenue, which is how Fortune puts their list together, when you look at globally, the only tech company to crack that top 10 was Amazon. And I think, you know, when you look at the number 1 spot, both global 500 and Fortune 500 at Walmart, you really see just, you know, a different point of view, and it's just fascinating.
I think it shows the disconnect, in my opinion, of you have your stuff you need every day, and there's someone who lives in a place whose power goes out for no reason whatsoever. I mean, there's a reason, but it's a, you know, badly, poorly managed and built grid. But power is the number one. You know, are some of the top spots, if not most of the top spots on that list. So I think people forget about what it takes to actually get things done, which is you need energy in some way. And again, outside of Walmart, but, you know, you've got a lot of these different energy companies ranking in the top 10. And it's surprising to me. Toyota was number 10, which is also interesting that another car company was up that high, but so Volkswagen's business, you pointed this out in your newsletter, but they were not in a good place a couple of years ago, right?
They had this big scandal where they were lying for a long time to regulators about emissions, and it cost them. There were lawsuits in the U.S. by states and the federal government and agencies, and it cost them to the tune between $15 and $20 billion. And, you know, it's kind of interesting how, like, that's a lot of money, right?
Yeah. Like, it's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. And the fact that they're able to sell cars, keeping in mind that cars are, they're a big ticket item, but they're also, you're not buying a car every year. So, you know, the idea that a company can take a $20 billion hit and still be one of the world's biggest companies, it's just a, to me, it was just an interesting data point to show how, you know, on the most cynical side, nothing matters. But on a pragmatic side, that if you are a company that is beset with scandals and has fines up to wazoo, that given time and good marketing, advertising, and ultimately good product, you can just brush it off. It's just an interesting perspective.
I've had this, and there are several examples, by the way, of companies like that. Wells Fargo comes to mind right away. Like feels like every year they're doing some bad shit, and yet doesn't matter. They get bailed out, and they still just keep going forward. And I think it speaks, at least it speaks to me, of, and when it's, we have a very different perspective looking at the mainland, because for the most part, Puerto Rico is not a consumerism-driven culture. It's a family culture. It's an outdoors culture. It's, you know, those kinds of things. So, like, when the pandemic first hit and all the stores were closed, yeah, there were some people saying, I can't go to Marshall's because that's like a big thing here. But it wasn't like people going nuts that they couldn't spend money. Mm-hmm. And I think when you build up an entire economy, like we're seeing with these forced reopenings and all this stuff, when you build an economy based on consumerism, like you said, the scandal kind of doesn't matter because I still need a car. And, well, they have a good ad and the car looks nice, so why not? It just keeps chugging along, even though there's there are some real problems there, that they had executives lying with a big consequence, and yet doesn't matter. To me, I don't know if that speaks to the power of branding or how hooked everybody is on consumerism.
I also think that there's a, you know, to draw perhaps a bad analogy, to the politics, right, and what's happening in the U.S., where for decades voters have consistently voted against their best interests, and voting for people whose policies don't match their ideology. And, you know, we saw that play out in 2016. We're seeing it now. We are just not a smart species, is what it comes down to, right? And, you know, when you are focused on your day-to-day, when you are focused on making sure that your kids are fed and housed and clothed and hopefully educated, and you're able to go to a doctor and take care of the things that you need to take care of, these bigger issues, we have a pretty good mechanism in our brains to kind of see what we want to see. So we know that companies do bad stuff. We know, you know, like if you were to sit and list on one column the things that you believe in, your values, your convictions, and on the left side of the page, and on the right side of the page, pick a company, any company, and look at how that company operates and behaves, you would not use that company's product or services. But yet we do, because we can justify, well, you know, I really like Nike shoes. They're really comfortable. I mean, yeah, it's not great that they, you know, have child labor. Now they obviously don't anymore. So they say this was an issue in the 80s, but they, you know, we'll use that as the classic example. But I can overlook that, or hell, look, Facebook, right? Like, we all know the challenges that Facebook has unleashed into the world. And yet, everybody has a Facebook account.
Yep.
I don't, but everyone else does.
On I had this discussion on Facebook. Someone had someone tagged me on something, and I try not to use any Facebook products at all. First of all, watching people partying or going to public places and during a pandemic on Instagram makes me want to throw my phone in the ocean. But Facebook's quite frankly become a fairly useless tool. You know, if I want to sell something, it's okay because it's a marketplace where it's not some weirdo from Craigslist who's gonna slit my throat or whatever, but or scam me. But I just don't find it as a utility. It's not the most useful thing in the world. And so just looking at their products, I'm like, I don't need these things. The problem that I run into is number one, I have to have an account for work because we knew it, you know, because of managing pages and advertising and things like that. And then WhatsApp is big in Puerto Rico. It's people use that instead of texting. I've tried to like get people off of it and they're like, they always revert back to WhatsApp. And I'm like, I cannot get out of their ecosystem. So it's like unknowingly or knowingly, they've worked themselves into people's lives. And it's like the mob. You just keep trying to get up. They pull you back in. It's like every time you turn around, they're snatching up the app or the thing that you were using that was somewhat enjoyable and ruining it. So, to your point, there are a lot of companies, like you said, if you were to take what they stand for or say they stand for versus their actions. And we have that as the ultimate example in the White House of don't look at what I say, don't look at what I do, just go by how you feel. And it's like, feel pretty shitty, man. Gotta be honest with you. So yeah, I think it's interesting to see that a brand or I've had this discussion with someone asked me for some marketing advice. It was a student about like, how do you approach marketing? Da, da, da. And, you know, when I was talking with her, I said to her, there's a part of marketing that matters, which is like visibility and like even the customer support aspect and those things. But it comes down to distribution and things that are much bigger than just running a tweet or sponsoring a post or whatever. I said, sometimes these things are as like Coca-Cola going to Delta Airlines and saying, you're only going to serve our products on your planes or McDonald's or whomever. So it doesn't matter that Coke advertises it really because it's ubiquitous. Everyone knows what Coke is, but what they've done is essentially gobbled up enough networks to make sure their products dominate, you know, are have a monopoly in those places. So the marketing is kind of just out there. It doesn't drive that much. So you don't really have choice. So at any rate, it just feels like a similar thing. How many car companies are there? Have they all done bad things? Probably. So now it comes back to how does it make me feel? Which is unfortunate, you know, and I think that's actually a segue into your business, which is into journalism. You know, that's one of the things that when you look at some of the more popular sites and apps these days, and I'm not going to give the sports one that I can't stand a name, I'm not going to mention them, but there is a sports entity that just basically is memes and being rude and childish, and they're popular because it makes people laugh at other people and makes them laugh. That's basically it. Or makes them feel superior in some cases. So the content's really dumb. It doesn't educate. It's not like, but yet they're popular while ESPN or, you know, name the local sports section of your paper. I mean, Jesus, when I was growing up, the sports section was massive. Mm-hmm. And now it's at best a few columns on a page. And so you did a piece recently about journalism and trust. And I wonder if there's an overlap there between I don't want to hear bad news all the time and entertain me. And that's where true journalism may be losing out.
Yeah, it's a tough needle to thread. And what we're starting to see is, let's also make it clear that this has been a conversation in one dimension or another for decades, right? Like when television hit the scene, you know, it's like, oh, you know, that the people started, you know, clutching their pearls because like, oh, well, you know, if people are on TV, that means no more newspapers. The idea of journalism also has changed over the decades. You know, it was rarely that independent, fair-minded, objective persona that we attach to it today. I mean, hell, if you look at reporting, let's use, you know, the Yankees, for example, sports writers back in the 1940s and 50s were hired by the ball clubs, not the publications. And from that, they would not disclose maybe some of the more salacious escapades of the ball players. And that actually changed, I want to say in 61 or 62, there was an incident at the Copacabana where Moose Garin, first baseman of the Yankees, Billy Martin, second baseman, Mickey Mantle, were involved in a fight. And it actually just came out recently that they got pegged for it when it was actually one of the bouncers of the club that was involved with the fight. But it got out because it wasn't a sports reporter that covered it. It was just another type of reporter. And so basically the point is this, is that the idea of objective journalism, the fair journalism, has changed over the years to this point now where we put it on a pedestal. And we have these conversations about objectivity, which is a misdirection at best, because you cannot be objective. You are a person, you're an individual. Writing a story, covering individuals, that filing it to an editor who they themselves are an individual, which means that everybody has their own experience and bias as they're writing, editing, reading the stories. What we should be doing, what we should be offering, is the search for the closest thing possible to the truth. And idea of fairness is not a, well, a thing happened, let's talk to this side, and then let's talk to this side, and let's kind of meet in the middle. It's call stupid shit out and don't worry about access. And, you know, you see this a lot in political media. You see this a lot in trade media, even sports media, right? These days is the idea that you can't, as a reporter, you know, it's very hard to be able to put a thought onto a page that isn't layered with something. You know, you look at, you know, I'll use trade media because that's, you know, the my area of knowledge, where you're covering people and companies that your publication is soliciting money from, not just for ads, but for awards and honors. So that changes the way that you're going to cover them, because your top editor might say, hey, you know what, like, let's not frame the story this way because we're trying to get some kind of deal with them or whatnot. It's hard. It's really, really hard. And what that does is that becomes a place where you start to see where the trust dies down. And, you know, while that, you know, that type of example is not equivalent across the board in other types of reporting, trust is down across the board in part because of media fragmentation. We are looking at content that aligns with our values and our systems, and anything that we believe in is good and anything that they believe in is bad. So therefore, I am not going to trust the other side. And when you have a society that looks at something at a superficial level, reads a headline, reads a tweet, doesn't read the fifth graph of a story, over time, this mentality of, well, I don't trust the media starts to set in. And for someone like me, that I'm trying to find the closest thing to the truth, it's painful. You know, and I look at my career. My career has not been a traditional journalist's career. I was in academics. I was in PR. I was in branded content. And that peripatetic career has given me a perspective that I can understand a marketer's point of view because I worked with them. I can understand the publisher's point of view because I worked with them. I can understand the PR person's point of view because I worked with them. So as a trade media, like, it makes my job a little bit easier because I can see where the closest thing to the truth is and where the bullshit is. And that's kind of like what I'm trying to do with the Media Nut, is find a topic, dive into that topic each day, and just write what I know is the closest thing to the truth. And hopefully, when I'm wrong, because I'm human and am wrong quite a lot, is that the industry can have the discussion to correct. And that happens. I mean, it happens in the comments. It happens on Twitter. It happens in my inbox. Oh, God, does it happen in my inbox? And I view that as that's the role of writing, of journalism, is that not just to inform or entertain, but to get people to start having the conversation so that they can make better decisions.
I think that there's also a piece of this, though, where you cited the stat about the number of PR people to reporters. Yes. And it continues to grow. Trust in the media being at this low point is also by design. You have bad people with bad intentions out there intentionally, calling out the media, not because they're looking for the truth, but they're looking to create more and more distrust. And we started to see this around when Fox News kind of came around. And not that the other cable outlets are, they are what they are, but there was a direct tie during the Clinton years with the GOP going on Fox News every day to create controversy, to make the other media outlets less trustworthy. And it was a concerted effort from the GOP towards the Democrats via the media. And it was like they took down both trust, trust in government is down, and trust in journalism's down. I thought I saw the Edelman Trust Barometer said that trust in brands is actually up, which mm-hmm. back to the discussion about Volkswagen, how they're not trustworthy.
I think it becomes more because I think there's a couple of tributaries here, right? One is that you are bombarded by messages from these companies almost every single minute that you are awake, whether it's a digital ad, a TV ad, a radio ad, print ad, whatever, a design on someone's shirt, the sneakers that people wear. Like, it's that consumerism mentality, right? So you're seeing these messages, but you're also seeing these products. And when you are looking for, a lot of this is also algorithmic, right? Yep. I'm looking for pillows, and I go into Google and I search for pillows, and I see all of these pillows. Well, what am I going to trust more to tell me about pillows? A pillow company that makes pillows, or a website that is putting together a list of pillows? Now, I might take the extra step and start to match up what the website, what the reporting says versus what the company says. But again, this is an overtime thing. This is not like, you know, you wake up one morning and like, oh shit, like, you know what? I'm going to trust Coca-Cola today. No, it's a years long play. And I think that is something that, you know, we should keep in mind, is that the reason why Amazon is among the most, I think the last, I saw a report last year where the most trusted organizations in America were the military, followed by the Postal Service, followed by Amazon. And the reason why Amazon is up there is because we rely on Amazon for our lives these days. So how do you, you know, you place an order on Amazon and you get your package in 2 days, and you do this every day, every week, every month, and you get your shit, you trust that company.
Yep. Yeah, they deliver, right? Literally, yeah, figuratively, literally.
But that's important, right? Like, yep. That's how Amazon is able to grow as big as they are, is because they deliver.
It sounds like, and if you look at the other people who rank above them, in theory, the military always delivers. Right.
Yeah.
Post office always, right?
Loose delivers.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, not these days.
Well, we've had quite an issue here, where packages sit in warehouses before they come here, and I don't know why that is or what's going on. But if you look at Amazon, the Postal Service, and Puerto Rico, we are being blackballed in some way. So I can only imagine, you know, I have a client in Israel who's like, I order stuff on Amazon that comes from the States all the time, and I get it almost next day. And I'm like, we don't have that here. Not anymore. It used to be okay. You know, it would take a little bit of time to get here, but now it's like months sometimes just to get a basic thing sent to you. It's pretty wild. So I think that's also being done by design. You know, there's a whole... Well, the political aspect of it is fairly fascinating, because why would you just want to create distrust in something that you trusted, which was the Postal Service?
Right. Well, when you got to vote by mail.
Yeah. I think there should be, I think one of the things that needs to happen, by the way, is that there need to be representatives from the parties that are going to have to drive it into the city halls, town halls, municipalities, and just hand deliver the stuff. Because if we can't rely on it, then we have to do it ourselves. But that's a whole other thing. So going back to the press, and with, you know, revenue is it's more fragmented, like you said, and journalism it's all a bit more fragmented. Is there a state in which, I mean, we talk about advertising, is there a state where free press is going to survive? Because it feels like more and more companies are now doing the paywalls and switching to, you know, the subscription service, which, again, I grew up in a household that got 3 newspapers a day. So I kind of grew up with subscriptions. So I don't think much about it. But, you know, when you have your most vital COVID information behind a paywall, that's kind of a problem. Is it all going to end up in these places where it's like, good news today sponsored by Amazon, and it's all going to be trusted, you know, not trusted, but kind of like back to the Yankees example you used, where the clubhouse reporter is the one that's going to be telling all the stories and the rest of you can go to hell?
I don't know. I feel like, well, one, if I knew the answer, I would have my own island somewhere in.
I mean, you live on an island now, right? Kind of. No.
The Mediterranean. So, you know, I think there'll be, you know, there are a few things. And this might be overly simplistic and especially naive, but, you know, I'll grant myself this delusional thinking for a moment. the press has always been in the United States a mess, for lack of better terms, right? So when you had the colonial press, and that led to the revolutionary press, and right after the Revolutionary War, like it was hyper partisan. I mean, you had people calling Hamilton and Jefferson and Madison the most vile of things. And it wasn't investigative. It was polemic. And the press has ping-ponged from all sorts of different types of missions, whether it's the political press that helped lead to political parties and fragmentation, to yellow journalism that helped, you know, spark wars. And then all the way through the, you know, late 20th century of the more investigative journalism, and then to the hyper attenuated journalism that we have now, with, you know, between aggregation and spewing out content just because you need to hit some kind of mystical ad impression goal. So the point is that the history of the press in the United States has always been, if not inconsistent, unreliable in how it was going to move forward. So you take that and you base that off of a foundation that the First Amendment that guarantees us a freedom of press. To me, I will, you know, that's why I remain, you know, I will be, if not optimistic, naive, that journalism as a function will continue, because it's a foundational cornerstone of our society. And we have built our American empire off of the idea of freedom of the press. The form that function takes, that's where the big questions become. And, you know, I don't know the answer. I mean, it could be a whole slew of things. You know, today I wrote about how magazines used to be run by circulation departments. And then that, you know, we are now seeing media companies kind of go from circulation to subscription to donation models, where companies like Vox and Talking Points Memo ask their readers to donate, not to subscribe, but to contribute, using language that is similar to what we would see in a nonprofit or even religious tones, that it's for the good of. So I can see a whole range of potential outcomes, but my thinking that the function of journalism to tell stories, to help us understand how the world operates, and for us to get closer to the truth, will remain as long as, and here's the caveat, as long as we all agree that we want to have a functioning democratic, liberal, lowercase d, lowercase l society.
That's part of what kind of scares me, is when you have a president talking about jailing people and actually jailing journalists and shooting rubber bullets at them, that now he's telling his base this is okay. And that's not right.
Right.
So back to the thing about what you said about models, you look at Defector, which you wrote about recently, Morning Brew, which you mentioned. It kind of feels like there's still like work being done out there to try to solve this. And the popularity of Morning Brew, for example, has shown that you kind of can create your own media ecosystem. So like whoever the publisher is, that's going to change. Or as long as the traditional publishing houses and what have you, if they can't figure this out, then to your point about fragmentation, I feel like there are some smaller players trying to figure out, or in the case of Morning Brew, kind of have figured out, right?
Yeah, and look, and you know, Morning Brew figured it out for now.
Yep.
You know, let's see what happens a year, 5, 10 years from now. You know, if you were to hop into my DeLorean and go back to, you know, 2012, we would be having this conversation, and instead of talking about Morning Brew, we'd be talking about BuzzFeed, right?
Yep.
Oh, but BuzzFeed figured it out. BuzzFeed's making a killing off of these things called native ads. This is the future. Well, that didn't quite last very long. So I think that's, you know, when you have a system, a financial system that is rooted in focusing on 90-day increments and not looking at years increments, when you have business model in media that is determined by renters versus owners, by which I mean, most media companies are operated through a VC-funded model, which means at some point the investors come knocking on the door asking for their return. Mm-hmm. A private equity model, which is, you know, you buy something for a buck and you sell it for two after gutting and rebuilding.
Don't forget about loading it up with debt and taking all the profits.
Right. Those are renters.
Yep.
We have very few owners, very few remaining families that control a media publication, and those that do are starting to suffer big time. The new houses at Condé Nast. I don't even know who else. My brain is, well, I guess the Sulzbergers at the Times are doing okay. Bezos at the Post is doing okay, but he's got, you know,
unlimited.
Yeah, like that, right? You know, Benioff owning Time. I mean, look, we've always had the billionaire benevolent benefactor. Oh, man, say that to each
other. Yeah.
That's always been a play, right? Think of Hearst and Pulitzer back in the, you know, the 1800s and early 1900s. But now, because you have this ongoing discussion between not just renting and owning, but when you look at the business model of ad-supported versus subscription, both have a lot of pluses, and unfortunately, both have a lot of minuses. So you've got an ad-supported system that when you are reliant on an advertiser and that advertiser pulls money, you see what happens, right? We saw it with, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic when advertisers pulled revenue because they were suffering too. Media companies went into a downward spiral. On the other side, when you have a subscription model, while you are relying on the dollars of your reader, that then changes the way that you cover things. Because if I am paying $500 a year for a publication and I am not happy with the stories that are being put out, I pull my money. And you do that in mass, you lose a publication.
Yeah.
So, you know, to find that Goldilocks model is really, really difficult. So you take someone like Morning Brew that does 90% direct marketing. They churn through advertisers. They might turn on a paid subscription model, but they've been able to build a user base of 2 million. So for them, it works. It also, I guess it depends on, as a media entity, what is your financial goal? Are you looking to become stupidly wealthy, or are you looking to, you know, eke out a life where you can do everything that you want to do, but you still got to pay the bills every month, right? So I think the incentives will determine how media pushes forward.
Well, I think it's something you said just kind of connected for me, which was, let's go back to the example we started with, which was Volkswagen. Because Volkswagen makes you feel good, right? You like the product and all those things. It feels to me like that's what media should be looking at, as whether they have a recall or not, whether they lied about their emissions or not, I still like them. They're still profitable, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know that the ad model to me has always been tricky. And working in a space where, you know, we've been part of sponsorships and having, I don't know if you remember this, when, you know, a friend of mine that does entertainment, I worked with him in the city. He got Ellen DeGeneres to do a live Oral-B commercial essentially as part of her show. So this kind of like branded entertainment of her brushing her teeth on air. You know, when you start to look at, I mean, I know that's been, it's always been around. Look at the cigarette industry and all the things like how they've pushed things, guns, et cetera. I just feel like there has to be, that to me is where it starts to crawl into that range of like not being sustainable. Whereas if you fall in love with the brand and the brand continues to morph and shift, whether it's introducing new products or whether it's changes in tone or whether it's, you know, having an insight into their reader to be able to do that and follow these trends, they may have a better shot at it. Because as you know, advertising comes and goes. I mean, it's, if I say something negative about whatever brand, there's no way in hell they'd ever sponsor this podcast. That's just how it works. I had that discussion with bloggers back in the day. When they were asking, how can I monetize? I said, my first piece of advice is that if you're looking to work with Disney, stop saying fuck on your blog. That would be a great start. But now you're censoring people. So then it becomes a whole level to this that the media, because they've been pounded so hard from a PR standpoint, and I don't mean from like the pitches, I mean like the negativity around media, that it feels like the overall category could use a rebrand or some kind of a push to change people's perception, or even on a brand by brand, you know, level.
Well, look, and to me, that goes again, that goes back to trust.
Yep.
And the implication for me, the implication here of trust is that, you know, I'm looking for the closest thing to truth, and I am going to trust that the reporters out there are doing that. And the waters have been muddied by bad faith actors who call themselves journalists, but are not. And that, I think, has been perhaps the biggest challenge that the media industry hasn't been able to accurately or appropriately cover. That the charlatans out there and the people who have these huge audiences that peddle bullshit don't care about truth in as much as what their audience believes or how to build their audience. All they care about is the audience. So that way they can go sell some kind of like, you know, natural Herbalife crap.
I was just saying, just take my quiz. Which herbal or which essential oil are you?
Yeah. Right.
And here's a code for doing it. Coupon code for doing it.
Yeah. So the bad actors that have proliferated off of the promise of the internet, which was to democratize media so that anyone with a keyboard and internet connection can post their thoughts, have taken it to a logically perverse level.
Yep.
And that's what actual journalists are up against.
Yep.
Well, and we now... No, go ahead.
I was going to say, finish your thought because I have another add-on for you.
But that's the end result is all of these things tie together, and now we are seeing the increasing likelihood that a supporter of QAnon is going to sit in the People's House as a representative from the state of Georgia. And it's mind-boggling.
Oh yeah.
And devastating.
Yep. Well, and you look at, so that kind of leads me into Twitter. Because I've been on Twitter for over a decade, I think 13 years now. And I remember when it first launched and thinking, wow, this is a powerful tool to just have conversations, to get the word out, to find people who are like-minded. It basically is a message board comment section, but there's no moderator. So they've been doing a lot of changes to their platform over the years, which have taken way too long, in my opinion. But that's what journalists are up against, is somebody who's standing there on a street corner that just witnessed a car accident, live tweeting what they just saw. And you hope it's a real person. You hope that event actually happened. But you don't know. You're just taking someone's word for it. And so I think that what Twitter did, what they did was, you know, recently they changed their platform so that you can now publish to, so that nobody can respond, or only people that you tag can respond. You can make it so only people that you follow can respond, or they've made it so that anybody can respond. And that, to me, that's an interesting thing, because what it's doing is it's trying to create trust so that the bad actors can't jump on a meme and try to hijack it with links or other hashtags or what have you. It's obviously not long form writing, but it's a way of getting to the truth, so to speak.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they did that they're still bantying about is, are they going to offer subscriptions, which would then take you to more long form content via some media channel partner, website, what have you. I don't know. To me, it seems like they're trying to fill that void in some way. I have not seen any sort of benefit from a monetization standpoint of doing that. Like not just from Twitter standpoint, the subscription stuff, we'll see what happens. But I think in limiting, like you talked about some of these bad actors, and it somewhat creates an echo chamber, but at the same time, it does kind of help validate the people that you are following, that they're real people, and that you become a source of trust.
Yeah, and like, Tim, the interesting thing is that when Facebook started, there was outcry that in order to join Facebook, you had to use your real name.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the thinking was, well, people are not going to enjoy having their thoughts attached to their real names. And yet here we are.
Yeah.
And I think Twitter, as its function as as a place where people get their information, they know that they've needed to do better. They've started to, I mean, it's in a way, better late than never, but at the same time, they're still woefully behind.
Yep.
The other challenge is that Twitter is heavily populated by journalists who love talking to themselves. And I would say people who might be more on the margins. I have a lot of very well-adjusted friends, and surprisingly, they are not on Twitter because they're not in media, so they don't have to be on Twitter. And I always found that to be an interesting distinction between Twitter and Facebook, is that no matter your station in life, you feel like you have to be on Facebook, whereas on Twitter, that's not the case. So I also kind of wonder if to use the Nixonian silent majority of people decided to get onto Twitter, what would that do to the platform? Would it make it better? Would it make it worse? Would it radicalize more people? I mean, And here, all, you know, we've been talking about Twitter and Facebook, you know, you have to throw YouTube into this conversation. There's all part of this.
On YouTube, you know, I've seen with YouTube, I mean, you know, having kids, you watch what they're seeing and you watch to see these algorithms and how they're functioning and what paths are taking your kids down, or even yourself. I mean, I'll watch a video because I search for whatever on their platform, and then the next video is something that's completely unrelated, and it's usually vulgar or just not of what I want to watch. But those algorithms have radicalized people. I mean, it's just, it's absurd, and it's insane that there's no regulation or rules around it that just do what you want. I think Twitter is a different animal, and this kind of parlays into the election stuff that's happening now, and why I think Twitter did do what they did, which is to keep the bad actors kind of away, keep the bots away from actual conversations. But, you know, YouTube just never did that. They never figured it out. And you can see, you know, for those of us that work in the space and know how to get to the source of truth, so to speak, which is the data, you can see where foreign influence and money is shifting and who it's going behind. And you can see it not only in the comments / responses, but also in the number of fake followers somebody has, their sudden rise to popularity because they're talking about being, we should get back to school, look at the numbers and the death rates, and da-da-da. You can see how these platforms are being influenced negatively by just money. Because all they care about is more eyeballs, longer time spent on the site. They don't care where the end goal is or where the journey takes you, which is a huge problem.
Yeah. Yep. The money aspect is, you know, that's it, man.
Yeah. We have the data. You want the data, pay for the data. We don't care who you are. We don't care if you're some snake oil, CBD, whatever unregulated stuff you're selling. We don't care, as long as you pay your ad bill every month or every week.
Mm-hmm.
It's I'm waiting to see how it's, so we know in 2016 how data was manipulated to create personas and essentially bucket people into different groups so that they would respond to different messages, usually based on fear. And then that was influenced by foreign money and all those kinds of things. With the nomination of Kamala Harris, we already see the bots are out in full effect. And I'm interested to watch how does that play out. Here in Puerto Rico, they had an image on TV of the 6 gubernatorial candidates. And I don't know what year they think this is, but they had their Twitter and Facebook following posted on the screen. And I'm like, you still haven't learned. Like, you still haven't learned a damn thing. But I wonder if consumers and or voters, more importantly, in the U.S. have learned from 2016. I feel like there is a massive, like even my mother, who's in, you know, the Reagan Democrat area of Detroit, the suburbs there, she said, she said Trump's not going to win. There's no way he wins. There's no way you recover from this. We said that in 2016 too. I feel like the pandemic's made things extremely real, where you can't have your distractions of sports and all the other things, and now you're looking at the TV. At least for me, every time I see his face on my newsfeed or whatever, I'm just like, you motherfucker, you caused this. Like, this is on you. But I'm waiting to see how it plays out. You know, like I said, moving forward, because it's just 2016 was awful. It was absolutely, I'm talking about just from a media and social media perspective. It made it unbearable.
Yes. Yeah.
There's not much to discuss. It's just, yeah.
No, it's there was a breakdown and a failure across the board, and you know, 4 years later, we just hope that the people running the show, running newsrooms, learned their mistakes. I am not sanguine that a lot of them have.
But he did change his tone. So,
Oh yeah.
So I want to get off politics from the rest of this because, you know, it's just, I can only ram my head into the wall so many times, but I did want to ask you, speaking of headbanging, see that segue? That's what the pros do, about your guitar player, right?
Yes.
I know you just are a guitar player or any other instruments or just guitar?
I mean, guitar is my main one. I can, you know, if you play guitar, you can play bass. Yeah. I play bass. I can play a little piano, and I know one drum beat.
Just one?
Just one.
All right. And I've seen, I'm pretty sure I've seen videos of and photos of your guitars, but can you tell us what do you play?
So these days I've got the one that I've been playing the most is I've got a Gretsch hollow body. Mm-hmm. And it's funny. So my kids know that guitar, and you know, I had a couple other guitars that were in the basement that I just decided to bring up so I can play around with, because I know that they've had some issues that I figured, hey, you know what? I've got nothing but time now. I might as well fix them. So I brought up, I've got an Epiphone 335. It's, you know, the cheapo version of the Gibson ES-335.
Yep.
I figured I want a semi hollow body. I don't need to go spend $4,000 on one. I can get one for 300 and change and it'll sound just as good. And then I've got a 96 Strat. So those are my electrics, and then I've got a couple of acoustics for the house.
Nice. I started playing piano when I was young, and then I don't know why, but I took clarinet in seventh grade.
Oh, nice.
Sixth or seventh grade, and I got bored with it, so I did 1 year of that, switched to trombone or trumpet, which I thought was too easy, so then I switched to trombone. And then I kind of just stopped playing instruments for a few years. And then my brother got into a band. He's a phenomenal guitar player. He just showed me a guitar that he bought. It's made in the UK, and I'd never heard it before. Apparently they just started making them like three or four years ago. And he's like a huge guitar like fanatic. It's got the Gibson and all that stuff. So we started this band, and we had like a Spinal Tap type of a problem with bass players where they just kept not showing up for practice or joining and then leaving or whatever. So I went to the local music store, and they had some used equipment. I bought an Area Pro 2 Cat bass, which I sanded down. I sanded that one down. It was a red, like a cherry red finish. I sanded it down to just wood. And then I bought an Ampeg head, solid state Ampeg head. It was a vintage head. And then a Fender cabinet. It was a 2x15 cabinet. So this thing was just, I mean, it had the original speakers in it. So when we used to gig and stuff, it was like getting a workout because you're lifting up the 75-pound box, trying to get it up into the back of a van or what have you. And then eventually I got bored with, I learned how to play bass because my brother was in the band and was like, I'll teach you. It's not that hard. Is that if you played piano and your hands were facing down, just take your left hand and face it up, and I'll teach you the rest. So I ended up acquiring a bunch of instruments over the years. And when we moved to Puerto Rico, I sold everything, which kind of was a little heartbreaking. Because the goal is, you know, like you're saving your old stuff, is that maybe your kids find it or want to play with it, or you just have it, you know, just to play on. So that part was a little rough, but I did end up picking up a Martin. I got my wife actually bought a Martin for me for, I think it was my birthday. So I still have an acoustic. It's acoustic with the electric capabilities here. But I know that, like I said, playing music to me is such a lost art. You know, not many, you don't see as many people doing it, as many people learning. I remember when Guitar Hero or one of these rock band type games came out, one of the social media douchebags was like, we're going to see the best guitar playing of our lives and more people will be into music because of these things. And I'm like, no, they won't. They won't. Mm. It's easier to push a damn button than it is to actually learn how to pluck a guitar string properly. So, and we've seen it. I stop in the local music stores here and I ask them, and they said most of our customers are around your age. we don't get a lot of younger people picking up instruments like we used to, which is, you know, I think there's something you said about music, learning music and brain chemistry and how your brain just thinks and functions. So, so anyway, I want to ask you, I know that you're a big Phish fan, and Phish, I'll take them out of the equation for 1 second, for at least one question. What's the best show you've ever been to that was not Phish?
Oh, so I don't know. I had a lot of fun. So 1994 was a pretty fun year for music for me. I got to see Pink Floyd and the Rolling Stones, so that was cool. I don't know, man. I mean, Nine Inch Nails opening up for David Bowie was pretty awesome.
That'd be a good show.
Yeah, that was at the Continental Airlines. Or whatever the Meadowlands. That was a fun one. Beastie Boys were cool.
When did you see that? When did you see Beastie Boys?
I want to say it was, I was in college, so it was the late 90s.
Okay.
Maybe. I mean, I always have a good time seeing Dylan. Steve Miller Band and Jethro Tull playing together was kind of fun. Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Tom Petty. I think that was that year.
You've seen a lot of classics.
Well, yeah, man. Like that's the music I grew up with.
Yeah.
I grew up listening to the Dead and the Beatles and the Stones and the Who and the Doors. And when I was, you know, I was lucky enough that when I was in my teens, you know, a lot of them were still alive.
Yeah.
And playing. I mean, a lot of them were also dead. But yeah, I got to see a lot of good music. And then, you know, of course, you know, as fun as all of them are, like those best shows are still not as good as the worst Phish show. So,
so I got to see Beastie Boys. My first concert that I went to by choice. Because I don't count when your parents say we have tickets and you're going with us as your choice. You're just going because you're a kid. You don't want to, they don't want a sitter, you know?
Right.
So that would be Neil Sedaka and Pointer Sisters that I did not want to go. I was a little kid. They're like, you're going. And so we went. But the first show I went to by choice was Licensed to Ill, downtown Fox Theater. And it was Fishbone, Murphy's Law, and Beastie Boys. That was a show. So yeah, I have a couple that I've been to that, my wife and I make a list where we're like, who do we want to see that we've not seen, who may not be here next year type of thing, which sounds so sad, but it's like, I want to make sure I see them before whatever. So, we got to see James Brown in Ann Arbor, back in the day. And we just try to always like try new things. So, we had tickets it was moved to October for Halloween, but they just refunded the money because it ain't going to happen. But we had tickets to go see Bad Bunny, which I know my kids look at me like, why do you like this? And I'm like, it's fun. I don't know. Like it's, he's like the most popular artist on the island and it's not even close. So, and the songs really do. I mean, the videos make them even better, but the songs do hit. Like, I hate to say it like that, but so let's hear your Phish story. What's it like? I've never been to a Phish concert. I've seen some videos and what have you, but what is that experience like?
I mean, for me, it's rejuvenating, cathartic, spiritual. It's just a very happy place to be. Generally, the people are pretty amazing. The environment is pretty chill, and the music is just, it's just great.
And how long are their concerts normal? I've heard they're going pretty long. Yeah.
Yeah, they're only about 3 hours. So okay. they play for like, you know, play between an hour, 15, hour and a half, take a 45-minute set break, and then play for another, you know, hour 15, hour and a half.
That's awesome. To me, the shows that when it's a good experience end to end, you got the music, you've got the people, you've got the environment. I mean, it makes all the difference. It makes all the difference in the world. So I'm going to have to, at some point, I don't think they come to San Juan, but if they're in Miami or someplace that's easily accessible, once all this stuff clears, then hopefully get a chance to see them. But
yeah,
I was just going to say, I've been wanting to talk with you. I followed you on Twitter for a long time and read your stuff. And I've been wanting to talk with you, and I appreciate you taking the time to come on today. It's been great.
Thanks, man. No, this was great. Thanks for having me on. And same, I really, we've been following each other on Twitter for probably a good decade at this point.
Yeah. It's been a decade.
Yeah. But cool. No, man. Thanks for having me on.